Welcome to the Spike Feed, your leading Magic the Gathering podcast. What is up? My name is Curtis, and I'm just your typical Spike. On the line with me, fresh from Vegas, with a sky blue V-neck, symbolizing summer. My good buddy and producer extraordinaire, Cameron McCoy. How you doing, friend?
Good, man. A little harried because it's been such a crazy busy week, but glad to be sitting down and talking with you about Magic.
Yeah, this is the second year in a row you've gone to Vegas the week after Grand Prix Vegas.
Yes, like really poor planning on my part and my wife's part, but yeah. Or my wife knows and says, hey, honey, there's really good tickets the week after.
Yeah. I think you're getting worked, as they say in the business. So, Cameron, we are knee deep in M19 spoilers. It's a interesting set. I mean, I think they're really bringing it for a core set.
Yeah, crazy.
But hey, we want to start out every week talking about what we've been doing before we get into the spoilers. So let me start with you, man. What have you been playing this week?
Yeah, so this week before all the craziness started, I thought, you know what? I'm just going to relax and play a game of Modern. That'll be right? That's the way to go. And so I played Jeskai Control in Modern with a friendly league and ended up going 1-4. And it was all because I'm playing Control in Modern when, you know, my opponent's casting Trons, or I'm sorry, casting, you know, literally everything on me. 15 Emrakuls? Sure, why not, right? Not a lot that you can do when they hard cast that. You know, it's like an auto scoop. So, and it's always interesting after a GP or something like that where there's a newish type deck that seems to be kind of like a little format changing, and a lot of people are playing it, so you see it a lot. But anyway, went 1-4, lost against the Crack Clan Ironworks combo deck, Tron, Mardu Pyromancer, Hollow One, and then good old Affinity redeemed me, and I was able to just get by, you know, with a good old Supreme Verdict against Affinity, and it felt so good, and I felt bad for that Affinity player, because what did he do to me, right? But, yeah, so Modern, man, I'm fine with it, I'm still fine with it, but I feel like I really need to say, Cameron, quit playing this deck, play something, as Curtis suggests, maybe a little bit more busted, a little bit more fast, a little bit more linear, and you might have more success.
So, Cameron, let's narrow that field,
mm-hmm.
right? Because I always tell you the way to improve our ratings is just to talk Modern, Modern, Modern. but what do you think would be the unfair deck of choice in this scenario? What would speak to you?
Yeah. For me, I think the thing that is like closest to my play style that seems fun and interesting, a little bit more interactive, and my decisions matter a lot more is something like Grixis Death Shadow. I feel like, you know, maybe it's not the best deck right now, but I like the interactions that I've had with Grixis Death Shadow in the past. So I feel like that could be like a fun alternative. I have a lot of the same cards, so it should be really easy to just kind of pivot to that deck if I want to. So that's where I'm at, and I should probably maybe next week or the week after go to that deck.
Okay. Well, coincidentally, I played that deck this week at a new shop and went 3-1 with it. And mm-hmm. I really like the deck in terms of a local metagame. I don't know if it's what I would want to play at a GP. I wouldn't say it's the most difficult deck in Modern,
mm-hmm.
but I think it's in that range. Like, you can definitely screw up and kill yourself.
Oh, yeah.
So that does happen. I mean, I still have Storm, but, you know, playing at a new shop, it wasn't something that I was really interested in. But did you get to play anything else this week?
No, that was it. So, I'll
Vegas, man.
Right? Yeah, exactly. So, I'll probably play some Standard this week. I'm interested where Standard's at right now, and I feel like I need to kind of get those reps in before M19 happens. So, yeah.
Yeah, I think the archetypes are largely going to stay the same.
They seem pretty, yeah, yeah.
I'll be interested to see, you know, because we talked about Nicole Bolas last week, if that'll go into blue-black mid-range and you'll just, you know, it'll become Grixis mid-range, or if the black-red aggro will splash blue to play Nicole Bolas at the top-ish of their curve. Of course, that deck also plays Glorybringer. I'm guessing black-red aggro will do better because you could play Spire of Industry, then you have four Aether Hubs and whatever.
Yeah.
So, but on the other side of that, the blue-black mid-range deck, going Nicole Bolas into Scarab God and then have like Torrential Gearhulk as the top year. Like, so there's a lot of really interesting things you can do. Obviously, you can't transform a token Nicole Bolas, but getting it to enter the battlefield and take a card out of your opponent's hand is it's not a bad deal.
Saucy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I'll just touch on Arena and Standard first this week. Like I said, I just played Modern. Then I kind of want to go more in depth with some buying, selling stuff. Some good old MTG Finance. Hashtag MTG Finance. So Arena, here's the thing. So there's been a lot of discussion about Arena and what is going on with how they handle wild cards. And I feel like I'm one of the biggest cheerleaders for Arena, but the wild card thing is a huge problem. Like right now, I think I have 40 uncommon wild cards, like 4 mythic wild cards, and 0 rare wild cards.
Weird.
Because you have to spend all of your rare wild cards on mana bases right now. And it is really hard to have more than one deck whenever you're approaching things like that. If I'm being super honest with you, that is the lone thing that holds me back. I actually have found myself playing the best of one constructed a lot more than I thought I would. In draft, I still prefer sideboarded games, which I think would not be what everybody thinks. But with constructed, I feel like especially constructed standard is such a canned metagame right now that I'm not really interested in playing. Like when I want to sit down and just relax, the key strength of Arena is that I can just knock out like 5 games. And it doesn't really cost me anything, and I can just knock it out. I play blue-white, I play blue-black mid-range. But yeah, the economy is kind of a mess in terms of the wild card situation. I don't know why they don't have a thing where you can say, okay, I want to turn this mythic wild card into 2 rares or whatever.
Sure,
you know,
yeah. Maybe some that's kind coming, of, I don't know.
Yeah, but, yeah, some outlet like that. But more importantly, and this has been like an ongoing thing that's happened over the last couple weeks, and I want to just share it to tell people to be careful. So there's a lot of this story I really can't tell because I don't want to involve the store and all this stuff. But essentially, at a local shop, I dropped about $1,000 on 2 cards. Okay? And about a week into me owning these cards, I discovered that they were, in fact, counterfeit. Now, here is the key to this. Naked eye, they looked real to me. I used a light test. I used, naked eye. I had another beta card that I put next to these other beta cards. And basically, the way you could tell with a naked eye is the top right corner. If you look at the back of a Magic card, there's those orange kind of dots, right? They look like rivets. Was the wrong color. The top right one was the wrong color. It's not until you have a jeweler's loop on it that you can actually see that what they call the rosettes, the actual print pattern, is incorrect. Now, this story had a happy ending. The store owner, once I showed up with the jeweler's loop and my example, got my refund, all those things. So I just kind of wanted to share this with people to just emphasize, first of all, go to Hobby Lobby, get one of those things. If you drop more than $200 on a card, because this put me down this like giant wormhole. And Cameron, you know how research obsessed I can be. Where I'll spend a whole night reading on pandemic strategies the night before we play, right? I just have that kind of like...
Yeah, yeah.
I would say I can't let things go, maybe is a good way of saying it. Maybe I yell at Cameron when he messes up in co-op Pixel Junk Monsters, for example. But anyway, but essentially these counterfeits are getting pretty dang good. And they are very common with older set cards, specifically Unlimited, but also mm-hmm. Beta and all these older things. And I would just advise, if you are buying these things, get yourself some kind of magnification. Your phone will not provide good enough magnification for this. Okay? Learn how to use a jeweler's loop, which is a little bit weird. It's different mm-hmm. than you think if you've never used one. And really check your stuff. I was mortified, of course. And then I also had gotten a dual land from somebody else. And I was like, I had never poured over a dual land more in my entire life.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I was so freaked out by this whole situation. But this also kind of was an impetus for me to reevaluate how I handle my cards and how I analyze them in terms of cost. So I downloaded an app. There's several apps like this. And by the way, this is not a sponsored mm-hmm. thing. The Spike Feed has no sponsors. We're just not that motivated. We're not that motivated to go out and get whatever. But this one's called MTG Manager. Have you ever seen an app like this, Cameron, where you can put it on a scanner? Like you can scan the card with your phone, mm-hmm. and it gives you an inventory and then gives you a market price.
That's nice. Okay.
So worst case scenario, and I don't have as much as you probably in cards, but if I get hit by a bus, right, I don't mm-hmm. want my wife to just throw out my cards. I want her to understand that, hey,
yeah, she gives them to me.
Yeah. We can pay for approximately half of my granite statue with
the marble bust. I love it.
Right. Just make sure that they add a little more hair than I currently have. That's an important part of the marble bust. But anyway, just saying, hey, look, there's this app on my phone. You can look at it and you can see my current value price. The other thing so I scanned like two of my decks, my trade binder. I didn't scan my whole collection and got a value price. And of course, this was kind of eye-opening to my wife. I think she was a little concerned, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And you kind of have that talk of like, okay, I didn't spend this money per se on this, but this is kind of how the value has grown, you know? So like, for example, with you, if you were to scan in your underground seas, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
But anyway,
I wonder if like I could be that bad of a Magic player that I've actually invested a lot more money and like what you actually have is like decreased in value. I guess if you're a standard player, maybe.
But one of the other problems that I have is like, so I have my collection kind of all over the place. I'm sure mm-hmm. you're probably much more organized than me.
But closet. Cards, that's the closet of money, right? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, they're basically the same thing for you.
Yeah.
I just have like boxes of cards and there's no real order. However, the stuff that I had from when I was a kid, like in the 90s, is in a separate set of boxes out of sheer laziness.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And every time something spikes on the reserve list, I find myself going through those cards that are in no order and mm-hmm. seeing if there's any value. Now, most of the time, stuff that is shot way up, I've liquidated that I knew I wasn't going to use. So, for example, Ancient Tombs were in there and I had sold them long ago, right? Mm-hmm. But I decided to pull out every single card out of these boxes that was on the reserve list. Okay? There's not currently in a deck. So translation, no dual lands.
Sure.
Okay? So I just wanted to put them in a box, set them aside. These are bad cards, most of them, Cameron. Okay? Mm-hmm. So I just want to quote for you the numbers. I set these aside in a box. There are 128 cards. And when I put them in, there were $221. Okay?
Yeah.
And I believe the most valuable card in there is $20. Mm-hmm. And these are stinkers, man. These are not good Magic the Gathering cards. They mm-hmm. are just purely reserve list cards. Okay? Kel'Jorian Outpost, I believe, is the most valuable one, and that's like a $15 card. Okay? It's something like that. So I did this on Friday. We're recording this on Monday. The value of that box has gone up 6.3%.
What?
And it's now worth $235. So I'm just...
Oh my gosh.
What I'm doing is just keeping these reserve list cards, and they're just in a box. I'm not touching them. They're not going in my trade binder. They're just staying there. Mm-hmm. And so I thought, as a show anecdote, as a person who has no interest in MTG finance, who doesn't care at all,
yeah,
let's see what happens.
This is great. Every single week in our show notes, we will put what the value of that box is, and we'll create like a... Yeah, I love this.
So we can see, and if the bubble burst and I just, you know, it collapses horribly.
Yeah.
Oh, well. Right.
But at what point, when that box is worth $10,000, do you say, Cameron, I'm going to sell this now?
I don't know.
I don't know. Dude, this is a great experiment, though. I love it.
Yeah, but it also leads you down this path. And I kind of had shared with you off air last week that I'm looking pretty hard at old school. I'm pretty intrigued by it.
Yeah.
Just to have like two old school decks that are, I mean, like the Moxes will be proxies or whatever, that I could just play with you or play with somebody else at the shop. The same way I keep two Pauper decks.
Sure.
In my bag, and you know, me and whoever else, I'm like, hey, you want to play some Pauper? Because sometimes the modern rounds go longer than they should. But yeah, I've been interested in old school and just kind of picking that up. So I've kind of been culling through my old collection and, you know, finding stuff. And some of that stuff is shot way up, like way, way up. But it's interesting that some of these rares from Homelands are just like worth something now.
Yeah.
Homelands, dude. Homelands. I can't say it.
I've opened a few packs. It's really bad.
Yeah. Yeah. But then I also get into this thing of like, so my favorite set from when I was a kid was Weatherlight. Like, bar none, I loved Weatherlight. I love that set. And that was the era where I was playing a lot. And I thought, you know what? I should buy myself a complete set of Weatherlight. There's like three expensive cards in the whole set. And I think the most expensive one is like $60. It is not an expensive set. There are a ton of reserve list cards in it. It's like, man, it would be cool, like, just for nostalgia purposes, to have a set of Weatherlight. You know?
Sure.
I know, to you, it's like, to you, that would be like a set of Born of the Gods or something. But
yeah, sadly, yes.
Just don't have that nostalgia factor, man. So, hey, dude, we're off on a tangent, but we'll just say this. The most half-hearted MTG Finance segment starts here, okay? We're doing it. We've got the mystery box. We're seeing if it's going up or down. We'll be right back after this. We'd like to thank a few of our patrons for continuing to support the show. Stephen Marshall, Brooks Dorsey, and Tom Stanton, thank you guys so much. If you'd like to become a patron, go to spikefeed.com and click the donate button. All right, Cameron. Mm-hmm. So we've got some serious spoiler backlog to go through. And M19, if I'm being super honest, is bringing the constructed heat a lot more than I thought it was going to.
Yeah, lots of hate.
Yeah, how do you feel about hate? So let's start with the Planeswalkers, because I feel like we kind of started there. Why don't you start with Liliana? Untouched by death. She looks like she's on a Hot Topic t-shirt in this.
It's true, yeah. So Liliana costs 2 colorless black for a Liliana Planeswalker with a loyalty starting out at 4 plus 1. Put the top 3 cards of your library into your graveyard. If at least one of them is a zombie card, each opponent loses 2 life and you gain 2 life. Minus 2. Target creature gets -X/-X until end of turn, where X is the number of zombies you control. And minus 3. You may cast zombie cards from your graveyard this turn. Sounds cool, but you're going to need a zombie deck, right? Yeah, so, right. I mean, like, everything on her surface is really, really powerful. Playing this with, like, Scarab God maybe can get you somewhere close to that, right? I don't know. But you're definitely going to need a zombie deck. And, like, it's really fitting a niche thing. And it's interesting that, I mean, Liliana has always had a little bit of a zombie thing going on, but nothing that's, like, really shoehorning you into a very specific type of deck.
Right. She is not a control/mid-range finisher in this incarnation, right? It is.
Yeah.
It is. I mean, I hope you like zombies, because we got zombies and we've got more zombies. And I don't know that this is good enough for standard. And this might be a, hey, let's pretend you play zombies in modern, which is theoretically a deck, like a tier 3 deck. This could be a sideboard card against a control deck that's bringing in sweepers. which are probably just bad against zombies anyway.
Yeah.
I'm struggling with this one. I mean, it's a high loyalty planeswalker, right? And it's four mana, which is a good, you know, good casting cost. And maybe we shouldn't print three mana Lilianas anymore because, my God.
Yeah.
But, right. Yeah, I'm very meh on this one. Okay. Yep. All right. So the one that I think is, you know, playing to type. So I just want to mention this. These are Elder Dragons that were originally in Legends, which is super cool. Now, these are not the same cards, obviously. They're different versions of the same legendary creature. But any callback is, I think, super dope. So this is Chromium the Mutable. It's 4 white, blue, black. So 7 mana.
Mm-hmm.
This spell can't be countered. Flying. Discard a card. Until end of turn, Chromium the Mutable becomes a human with base power and toughness 1/1, loses all abilities, and gains hexproof. It can't be blocked this turn. So, this is the Pearl Lake Ancient of this set. I feel like... I feel like this is a very good card. However, you're not going to play this unless you are Esper and you are playing against another control deck.
Yeah. Yeah.
End of story, right? Like, dude, you do not want this in your hand and your opponent cast a Bowmant Courier. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah,
like,
right? Yeah.
Which... Have I already mentioned today how much I hate that card? I've just come to the conclusion
I think on a side conversation we've had, maybe, but...
I think it is my least favorite Magic card of all time. I didn't think anything could beat Valakut, the Molten Pinnacle.
Mm-hmm.
Oof, I really don't like Bowmant Courier. I don't know what was going on when they made that card. What do you think of Chromium, dude?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think it's exactly the type of control finisher that you might want to be playing. It feels kind of like Aetherling, you know, or Dragonlord, Slumgar, you know, like these things that existed in like standards past where it's like, yeah, you might run two of in your control list and use it. I mean, Flash on this is also something we didn't mention, I don't think, but that's also, I mean, pretty powerful on its face as well. So being able to flash this in and then start swinging the turn, you know, the subsequent turn is pretty powerful as well. So good. I mean, we'll probably see it a little bit, but it's not going to be, it's no Teferi. We'll just say that.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, Teferi in the blue-eyed decks, he is the deck. Like,
yeah, yeah.
He is the whole engine, the whole driving force for the whole thing. So, by the way, did you see Teferi's seeing play in Vintage?
Wow. A 5-mana planeswalker. That's amazing.
You're playing Lotuses. Whatever.
Sure, sure.
So, all right. So, Cameron, why don't you give us Resplendent Angel?
Yeah. We got a Resplendent Angel. It cost 1 colorless and a white with a power and toughness of 3/3. It's an angel with flying. At the beginning of each end step, if you gained 5 or more life this turn, create a 4/4 white angel token with a flying and vigilance, and then you can pay 3 colorless, 3 white. Until end of turn, Resplendent Angel gets +2/+2 and gains lifelink. I like this card a lot. I like what it's trying to do. And if you can find the right deck for it, it might work really, really well. I mean, just its ability on itself to, like on turn 6 or whatever, be able to just swing 5/5 lifelink is awesome. There's so many other ways that you can gain life that I feel like this is... A very powerful card in whatever deck that is, whether that's like a white weenie deck that we have, I don't know, but it's definitely powerful.
So I'm kind of right there with you. My gut reaction was this is an overrated card. And then as I've kind of stewed on it over today, I've liked it more.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of that has to do with the fact that it is just a 3-mana 3/3 flying, which in a lot of formats is perfectly fine. I mean, yes, you want to build to the upside and you want to do the thing, but that's the versatility within this card,
mm-hmm.
right? I think if it was those casting costs were reversed and it was 6 mana and then 3 mana activate, this card would be unplayable. But because you have that versatility built in, it's kind of a scary little mid-range card that can get out of hand pretty quickly. Because you have, I mean, you have to answer this. Now there are, there is a scenario where standard is just straight up too fast. It is also worth pointing out that this is, fatal pushable, but, and also cast downable. So, and while we're at it, seal awayable, right? It doesn't have vigilance.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of like weird things going on with this, but I don't think, you know, the Crested Sunmare combo deck, I don't think that's what we're talking about here.
Probably not, right? Yeah.
I think this is just a utility card that might just be that good. I really like this with Lana Werewolves, like a more green-white-ish.
Yeah.
Anything that can kind of power this out a little bit quicker. The problem, of course, with Lana Werewolves is Goblin Chain Whirlers out there. Just making everybody's life miserable.
Fun fact. Yeah.
And don't worry, like if you're wondering, can you block Goblin Chain Whirler with Resplendent Angel? The answer is no, because the Chain Whirler has first strike for like no reason. So that's pretty cool. All right. Tezzeret, Artifice Master. Am I speaking your language yet, Cameron?
Go on.
three blue blue. For a legendary Planeswalker Tezzeret. He comes in with 5 loyalty. Plus 1, create a 1-1 colorless Thopter artifact creature token with flying. 0, draw a card. If you control 3 or more artifacts, draw 2 cards instead.
Love it.
Minus 9, you get an emblem with, at the beginning of your end step, search your library for a permanent card, put it on the battlefield, then shuffle your library. I wish this card had a spot in standard. And maybe it will with Karn. Like, you know, maybe there is that blue-green Karn, Turbo Karn deck. Like, the abilities on this card are really good.
I don't know. Drawing 2 cards, that doesn't sound that good.
I just don't know if building your deck around artifacts can justify it right now. Like, we can both agree that Karn's in this deck. Right?
Yeah, these two are synergized so well together.
But the question is, what is the rest of what you're doing? Because remember, when Channel Fireball played that deck, they had to play some pretty, let's say, not so wonderful artifacts to make the Karn really strong, right? The other thing I would mention with this is, in older formats, it's pretty interesting. I like it out of the side with the Ghoul Caller's Bell deck, the artifact deck with Ensnaring Bridge.
Yes. Continue. Yeah.
I this is the second time on the show I've brain farted on that deck. But this would be pretty interesting in that deck, man. What do you think?
Yeah. I love every single activation of this. I mean, the ability to just search in whatever. I mean, like, that is game finisher. And you can get there, I mean, 4 turns. Like, that's faster than Jace a lot of ways, right? So I love that ability. I love just being able to get a 1-1 to protect or do whatever you need to do. And drawing 2 cards, man, like, I mean, that is... I mean, if you can divination multiple turns, I mean, that's a huge advantage in Tempo Swing that you can gain. So everything about this is interesting. And I'm really interested to see if people will put this in a Tezzeret deck. You know, I feel like it might have a place. So definitely like this card. You're right. Standard, it's kind of questionable. I feel like you might be shoehorning it in. Especially post-rotation, but, you know, who knows what happens after rotation.
Yeah, it's really hard for me to come up with what am I doing before Karn and Tezzeret that are good.
Well, maybe they'll reprint the Moxes, and then, you know, that might change things.
What about Time Vault? Let's just get Time Vault up.
Oh, there we go. Yeah.
All right, Cameron, how about Alpine Moon?
This is probably the card that I'm, like, most intrigued by. I like it. Alpine Moon, it costs 1 red for an enchantment. As Alpine Moon enters the battlefield, choose a non-basic land card name. lands your opponent's control with the chosen name, lose all land types and abilities, and they gain tap to add one mana of any color. So you're shutting down a Tron land and just giving them a City of Brass, essentially, that doesn't shock them or pain them, right? So I like this. I like how specifically hateful this card can be. It might fit into certain decks where, like, if you're playing a three-color deck and you don't want to be shutting down your own deck with Blood Moons or whatever, this might be the answer, right? I love this against, like, Wasteland if you're playing a non-Wasteland deck. Lands, I mean, like, there's so many places where I feel like this might be a very specific card that might be very impactful in the sideboard. So I like it.
So it's interesting in that, so let's just say I'm not sold, but I don't play the Tron Mirror. You know, I don't play the Lands Mirror. So things like Blood Moon are just out of the question in those scenarios, right? But because this only deals with your opponent's lands, it's not symmetrical, which is really unusual for a card of this type.
Yeah, I didn't even read that, actually. So, like, I wasn't actually processing that it's your opponent. That's awesome. Okay, sorry.
So, yeah, like, if you're in the lands mirror,
yeah,
you can name... I mean, it depends on the scenario, right? But you could just name Dark Depths, and they can't combo out, right?
Yeah.
So, like, it's very unusual. Now, the other one, the moon that we got last set that was also randomly Tron hate, allowed you to draw a card. But this is like a turn one, because the big problem with playing against, and I think this has happened to everybody in Legacy, you're playing against lands, you slam down a Blood Moon, and they go, okay, crop rotation, float a black, and you're like, here we go. And they abrupt decay your Blood Moon on the spot, and you're just like, cool. That's it, you know? Man, crop rotation is a busted card. It does not get nearly enough credit for being as good as it is.
It's great.
But
yeah.
Anyway, this card is sideboard, very sideboard specific. I think if you're trying to think, like, if you're somebody like Storm and you're playing against Tron, first of all, don't even play Blood Moon. Like, just kill him. You know what I'm saying? But I think there are scenarios where those cards are better. And Legacy, there's a lot of scenarios where Blood Moon and Back to Basics are a lot better than this card.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
But the interesting one, I think, is if you are a Jund deck or something that can actually put a clock on, like Grixis Death Shadow, and you name Valakut, I have a really tough time imagining Scapeshift can beat you, because they have to produce enough, they have to ramp up and kill the Alpine Moon in time, right? Which is kind of a tall order. A lot of times when they sideboard in their enchantment hate, they slow their own clock down by a turn or two. Not every time, but a lot of times. All right, so last one I wanted to go over is Amulet of Safekeeping, which is the weirdest hate card I think I've ever seen. Okay, multiple people have talked about this. So it's a 2-mana artifact. Whenever you become the target of a spell or an ability, an opponent controls, counter that spell or ability, unless its controller pays one. Creature tokens get -1/-0. Now, here's the question I have. So, obviously, yes, this is one in a long line of cards that's good against Storm. Congratulations. And Storm still is going to have a substantiate, whatever it is, random artifact hate that they're going to cast on your instep to still Storm out. So you have to have multiples of different things to really kind of lock down the game. But the question I have for you, Cameron, is this playable in other scenarios? So let me give you a scenario. I have this in my sideboard, and I am Legacy Miracles. Okay? And I'm going up against Pox deck.
Sure.
Should I bring in this card?
Yeah. I mean, right? I mean, they normally have two lands on the field, right? So, yeah, for sure.
Yeah, like, that's just a weird question. It's like, okay, do you bring this in against Modern Burn?
Mm-hmm.
Because now you've effectively taxed them. And if you have two of these down against Modern Burn, it's really tough for me to imagine a scenario, because like almost every time that Burn, I play against them, they have three or four lands.
Yeah.
In play.
Yeah,
and like,
no, they're pretty slow. Not slow. I'm sorry, but yeah.
They're efficient with their mana when they're doing it correctly, right? So that's the thing that I don't know about this card, is this is like, obviously it's a sideboard card. Obviously it's a very specific sideboard card. Obviously it's crap against actual tokens decks because they have like intangible virtue and whatever. But yeah, I just like, is this actually good enough for other scenarios? Like, because this makes discard spells cost two. Like it really affects a lot, you know?
I like it. I like it a lot. I mean, it seems pretty good. I mean, like, I'm trying to think of like other ideas, but like, I mean, just the idea of, yeah, Storm is just the obvious one. Just with even like creature tokens, you know, how many goblins doesn't really matter, right? I mean, they can storm out and then you cast this and all of a sudden they can do nothing. So that's really fascinating though, that you bring this in for maybe some other things. So this could very well be like that role player that we see in a legacy deck. And I like the idea of just having more artifacts in the sideboard, just because they can become very important, especially once Alpine Moon and Blood Moon and all these other effects go into effect. So I like it.
There is also another hate card that we're not going to talk about. That's an artifact. It takes away hexproof from a creature or from an opponent. So like, you know, being a little on the nose, but you know, I like this kind of card. It actually reminds me of older Magic, where the text boxes were, shall we say, a little bit more dense, but you always felt like there was this weird kind of balance to things. Because like, you know, hey, if you're playing white, you're playing some number of disenchants main board. That's just what you did, you know? So it was really about having answers. Anyway, so M19 so far, I'm positive. I'm really positive.
Yeah, I like it. I like just how specific they're going after certain cards. And it seems pretty good.
Yeah. Okay, Cameron, we're going to get out of this segment. We're going to talk about a few other things just very briefly because we're running a little bit long. We'll be right back. So, Cameron, you don't have a lot of extra things to go through this week. Did you play anything on Switch while you were in Vegas? Or
No. I mean, I've read a few books. I read actually a really good sci-fi book. I could just talk about that really quick. Isaac Asimov, he's, you know, like one of the big sci-fi guys, right? Yeah. And I've read a lot of his stuff, but recently, last week, I read through The Gods Among Us is what it's called, and it's really good. It deals with like the Earth like finding an unlimited power supply that they get from an alternate universe, because the universe's physics operate differently than ours. And then it's learned that it's actually adding more mass to our own galaxy or our own universe, and like the sun's going to explode. And so it's about like just problem solving and figuring that out. There's not really anything. I mean, there's some characters, and we actually go into like the other universe, which is really interesting. But it's fascinating. It's such a classic, like Asimov story. You know, I mean, I really he's hit and miss with me. Where sometimes like his Foundation trilogy that he's done is just, I don't like. I think it's just it's too broad, and it just doesn't really strike a balance with me. And then there's other things like this that just are focused and really, really entertaining. So there you go. I read a book, and there's Cameron's book review.
Oh, nice. I like it. That's kind of my thing with like Neil Stephenson, is I feel like when he hits, he really hits hard. And then other times he's so into the abstract science of what's going on that the characters get really lost. Like there's some of the Neil Stephenson books I've read that I can't tell you any of the characters' names, right?
Sure, yeah, yeah.
So anyway, wanted to talk just super quickly to hit you with a new thing. So in terms of video games, I'm back on Assassin's Creed Origins. I wanted to finish that with my spare time, and so, you know, I'm like on hour 25 and like not even halfway through it. It's like the longest nice. Game of all time. We hadn't really had a chance to talk about this, Cameron. Tell me what you think of this. I'm kind of feeling like I should switch my pre-purchase copy of Red Dead to the new Assassin's Creed.
Does it come out close together?
They're like within a week of one another. Ooh. The new Assassin's Creed is ancient Greece.
Yeah.
And you get to float around, you get to sail around the Mediterranean and go to the different Greek islands. Mm.
I hope they get an Odyssey patch in that where it's just like your Ulysses and yeah, there'd be Odysseus, I should say, but yeah, that'd be sweet, man. That could be cool.
But yeah, that really scratches my itch. Whereas Red Dead, I also love and I think is a classic, but I've got my concerns about the sequel.
I was going to say, you're a little worried. That's understandable.
But no, here's what I did. Today, my daughter and I both had the day off. So I'm kind of going through this project. My daughter's 11, of taking her through the films in which I think are important to see. Okay? We've hit the Back to the Future trilogy, for example. Of course, she's kind of grown up around Star Wars, so to her, that's kind of like old hat, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But I decided that it's time for her to see the Christopher Nolan Batman films. And today, we watch Batman Begins. And it's the first time I revisited that film in years and years and years. And I was really worried that I would actually dislike it now because it's post all the Marvel films, basically, right?
Mm-hmm.
But I got to be honest with you, Cameron. My recollection of that movie was pretty much spot on. And I feel this way about all the Nolan movies. I love the first hour of every single Christopher Nolan Batman movie. And I actively dislike the last 15 minutes of every single one of them. And this bore out. Now, it was really interesting to see my daughter react to this because she had never seen ever a live-action Batman film.
It's crazy.
So none of the Tim Burton stuff because we don't watch that in my home. And, you know, the Justice League and Batman v Superman stuff I watched downstairs. I don't want my daughter to see me in that level of distress. But dude, it's so interesting that DC went from really a promising, I mean, really, especially around the time The Dark Knight hit, you really felt like we are going to get great comic book movies out of DC. Whew. It's not been great since. But I also want to say, give a peek into our friendship, Cameron. One of my fondest friendship memories of you is when the first trailer for Batman Begins came out. Mm-hmm. You and I were in the studio and we watched it together on an iMac in the studio, and it like the QuickTime window for it was like 3 inches diagonally, and we were like nerding out so hard. You remember that?
I do. I was like so excited to see like a bat tank. Or whatever it was, you know, it was just like so unusual because we were supposed to get like a hot rod or whatever. And
yeah.
Oh, man. Super excited.
But yeah, what's your reflection on those films? Like,
yeah. So I totally agree with you. Like, I would almost, I think, like, The Dark Knight is like a masterpiece on so many levels, like on a production level, I think. And I love the performances in that, but there is something about Batman Begins that really feels like a Batman movie. Whereas like The Dark Knight feels like Batman in the Heat universe, like a Michael Mann film. I feel like Batman Begins feels like it's like I'm reading Frank Miller's Batman Year One, right? I mean, like they really took like certain pages right off the book and tried to adapt them to the screen. And I find like a lot of those moments in that first Batman movie thrilling and exhilarating. Like the first time you see that the Batmobile, you know, careen out and it has like that high speed chase with the cops. Man, it's so fun and it still is energizing. It's been like a couple of years since I've seen the film, and actually I need to go and watch it again. But man, that's the stuff that I'm just like, all right, I am ready for. My Superman Returns or whatever that was going to be, you know, like it was all scaling up and it was going to be amazing. And it kind of, you know, topped with me with Dark Knight.
Yeah. Yeah. And like the one I'll be the most interested to rewatch is the third film because I've only ever seen it once. Mm. And I remember liking it, but not hating it and not loving it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I know, like, it's really difficult for them because, you know, with Heath Ledger dying, they had to apparently massively rewrite what their plan was because the Joker so heavily factored into what was going to be the third film. So I understand that. But yeah, dude, it's a good film to revisit. The weirdest thing I would mention is, boy, the DVD copy doesn't age well. I got through the DVD menu. I was like, nope, we're running this in HD because, like, it looked bad on a big TV. Like, there's so much, like, dark, like, you know, because not to get it too much into the technical stuff, but, you know, newer TVs express different shades of black better. And that DVD was not made for that kind of TV because the film has, like, I don't know how many different shades of, like, gray to black, and it just expresses it like a bunch of pixel vomit. It's terrible. So, just as an FYI, get yourself the Blu-ray copy. All right, Cameron, if someone would like to get in touch with you and talk to you about what unfair deck you should play in Modern, where could they find you?
Please, on Twitter, at Cameron_McCoy.
And I'm at Curtis Now. Our official show feed is at SpikeBeatMTG. We will check you guys next week.
Going in 3, 2, 1, go.
Go. I forgot to tell you because I edited last week's show. I didn't have to move your sound at all. I just imported it and it lined up perfectly.
That's impressive.
Is that not the most insane thing ever?
Yeah.
I don't know if there's any other more clear indication that we have a we've been doing this too long together.
Also, it's a double dragon sort of thing, right? Where we can just like
yeah. Also, my settings have been changed, and I'm clearly talking through my webcam mic, so I'm going to turn this audio off.